Members of the House Elections Committee will come to order. We do not yet have a quorum. Hopefully, we soon will. We have three bills today. My intention is that we will take a vote on Representative Lane's House File 664 and Representative Halverson's File 979. They are kind of housekeeping bills. But with Representative Winkler's bill, my suspicion is, because a lot of people want to be heard on this, it is a major piece of campaign finance change, that we may end up laying that one over. But we will want to take a vote on it on Tuesday then. Okay. So, and members, I'm going to have to leave myself at some point for a meeting that I can't change. And so Representative Halverson, our vice chair, will chair. But then when her bill is up, Representative Sanders will chair. So with that, I can't move the bill yet because we don't have a quorum. But Representative Lane, if you're prepared. We won't make the formal motion yet, but to your bill, please.
So this bill is the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board's technical bill, and it is just that, very technical. And with that, I will hand it over to Gary Goldsmith.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure my phone is off. Yep, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board, and I will just briefly go through the sections of this bill, as Representative Lane indicates. It's a technical bill. I don't believe there are any provisions that are controversial, and it has no financial impact on the board. The Section 1 modifies the definition of public official, and this section was actually not originated by the board, but rather was originated by the two offices that are affected by this section, that is the Office of Senate Counsel and Research and Fiscal Analysis, which is actually a name change, and also the House Fiscal Analysis Department. Mr. Marks and Mr. Bodern were in contact with me regarding this. They were going to have it introduced as an amendment, and I said since the bill was in drafting, we would put it in the bill. The roles of fiscal analyst and researcher have become blurred over the years, and so both of those offices felt that it was more appropriate to have fiscal analysts also included in the group of people who are considered public officials under Minnesota statute. So this is their recommendation, and the board has included it in their bill, in our bill, at their request. Section 2 is a technical language change that you'll see in at least one other part of the bill. The Chapter 10A right now has a few offenses that are criminal offenses, but the way the language of the bill reads is it says a person who does this is guilty of a gross misdemeanor or misdemeanor. And of course, the person isn't actually guilty until they've been charged, tried, and found guilty by a court or a jury. So this is simply a restatement of the existing language. Instead of saying is guilty of a gross misdemeanor, we say a willful violation of the subdivision is a gross misdemeanor, and then it's up to the prosecutors and courts to do the prosecution. Subdivision 3 relates to lobbyist and principal filings. It increases the late filing fee and civil penalty to be consistent with the same penalties for others filing in the campaign finance program, so it's the same as reports that you file with the campaign finance board. It also removes a grace period, which was removed from other provisions when we did our amendments in 2010, but at that time was not removed from the lobbyist reporting requirement. Section 4 is another change in the way a misdemeanor crime is specified, similar to the one I previously discussed. Section 5 changes a provision that we intended to change in 2010. We made all of the reports cumulative from January 1st through the end of the year, but inadvertently left the year-end report as not being cumulative, so this would fix that problem. Section 6 also fixes a drafting error. If you read the existing statute, and this relates to filing of campaign finance reports, It says that if the report isn't filed within 10 days after it was due, the board can impose a penalty beginning the day after the report was due, which is an inconsistency. And it was the intention in 2010 to eliminate the grace period, and we do that in two places in Section 6. Section 7 is a little bit more than technical, but something the board has noticed and has not been controversial. There are political committees and funds, and then there are groups that are not registered with the board, which are called unregistered associations. Technically, if you read Minnesota Statutes Chapter 10A, an unregistered association could give a candidate as much money as it wanted to. It could give during the legislative session, and it would not be subject to the same penalties as donors who are registered with the board. And it's quite clear that this was an oversight, and the board advises those associations that they should assume that they're treated the same as political committees and funds. This would put that into statute so that those associations would be treated the same as regular political committees and funds and would not be able to give money during the legislative session. Section 7 also deletes from the prohibition during the legislative session dissolving principal campaign committee. And the board is concerned about this because your committees, who are active and ongoing, can give money to your caucus committees during the legislative session. But for some reason, a committee that was dissolving and not going to go forward would not be able to, and there's no logic to that requirement, so the board is proposing that that simply be deleted. And Section 8 does the same thing with the civil penalty by removing the dissolving principal campaign committees and adding those unregistered associations to the same civil penalty that already exists. Section 9 is a very technical change related to the name of the account in the state's accounting system through which public subsidy is paid. It is, in fact, an account, not a fund, so Minnesota Management and Budget asked us for the change on line 5.13. Line 5.17 and 18 add a new account that would be used for payment of public subsidy in special elections. And the reason for the need for a new account is right now that money goes through the board's operating budget account, and so it becomes confusing when you see reports about the board's budget. This would create a special account so it would be treated the same as other public subsidy. It has no effect on the actual payment or amounts of public subsidy whatsoever. Section 7 corrects a date by which the Commissioner of Revenue must certify to the board the amounts to be paid for public subsidy, and it makes that date come before the primary. When the primary was changed, that date should have been changed, and it wasn't. And then on page 6 at line 6.4, there's a requirement in statutes that candidates spend half of their general account public subsidy money before the closing date for the pre-general election cutoff. If they don't, they have to return the part they didn't spend. The board believes that this is more detailed management of how a candidate handles their campaign spending than is necessary. We almost never see violations of this requirement. It adds an additional burden to the board to keep on top of this and notify candidates. It would not affect the requirement that a candidate does use all of their public subsidy for campaign spending in the election year. It would just leave the timing of that spending to the candidate. Section 11 is the corollary to creating the new account for special election public subsidy. As you'll see at line 6.29, previously that money was appropriated to the board. The money now would be appropriated to the special account for distribution by the board. Subdivision 4 is another restatement of a misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor penalty similar to the two that I previously discussed. And all of Article 2 is conforming changes simply to make the rest of the law conform with the change to call the state elections campaign fund an account rather than a fund. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lane.
I'll just make it a little more homey after I describe Section 7, where dissolving principal campaign committee can now give money in their dissolution to during a session. An example would be Kate Knuth dissolving hers and rushing to my door the day before session began to make sure she donated before the session began so she could dissolve her campaign. And Bev Scalzi perhaps having a campaign for House and now being a campaign for Senate, and she wouldn't be able to give to herself during session. So these have been taken care of.
Thank you, Representative Lane. Members, any comments, questions, concerns about the Campaign Finance Board technical bill? Any members of the audience who wish to be heard on this bill? Okay, seeing none, then Representative Lane renews her motion that House File 654 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lane and Mr. Goldsmith. Next, we have House File 979. Representative Halverson. As we're getting ready for this bill, we do have a quorum, members, so Representative Lane moves approval of the minutes of our meeting of March 5th, 2013. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Representative Halverson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 979 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register, and I have an A1 amendment to this.
Okay. You want to move the amendment?
I will move the A1 amendment.
Okay. To the amendment, Representative Halverson.
This amendment just takes out some puts back in some language about requiring publication in local newspapers. I think that there is some desire for us as a legislature to take a look at the way we modernize our communication and make sure that we are communicating what sample ballots are going to look like to the public. But for the sake of simplicity, it's this is just a better form for this bill to be in at this time.
Okay. Members, any comments, questions, concerns about the A1 amendment, the author's amendment? Okay. Anyone in the audience who wishes to speak on the A1 amendment? Okay. Seeing none, all in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Now to the bill as amended, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 979 changes some provisions that county auditors around Minnesota and other local government officials have looked at in terms of modernizing our election system. We have, as you go through the bill, you may notice that there is some technology that is quite outdated that is referenced and required in the bill, such as cassette tapes. And so it gets rid of references to obsolete technology. It also, because of the Help America Vote Act, changed some of our requirements. A number of provisions in election law currently are outdated, such as requiring certain color ballots to be printed. And so this updates and modernizes our election system and eliminates some obsolete language and provides stronger oversight for our local units of government and local election officials. And with that, I would like to introduce Debbie Erickson from the Minnesota Association of County Officials to speak to the specifics of the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Erickson. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Debbie Erickson. I'm with Crow Wing County Elections Coordinator, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Officials as the co-chair of the Elections Committee. With regard to House File 979, this is a bill that was put together by local units of government. We have done this in the past. Every so often, it's not uncommon for the auditors to bring a bill to the legislature to take care of some of these technical issues. In this particular instance, this year, we worked together with the League of Minnesota Cities, Association of Minnesota Townships, and also with the School Board Association to put together this information and bring it forward. The goals of the bill this year are to streamline the administrations of elections in Minnesota, revise and eliminate obsolete and unnecessary provisions of the law, clarify certain instances in the law where there has been some confusion or disagreement about what the law requires, and reduce administrative costs when possible. With regard to the cost savings of the bill, there are a number of things that we believe could benefit all local units of government, counties, cities, townships, and school boards across the board. One provision to eliminate the requirement to maintain a TDD line would ultimately save approximately $57,000 per biennium statewide. The use of the TDD line is not very common anymore. There are other avenues for people to receive the information if they do need to have that type of assistance. And without having to maintain the item that has not been used for many years, there would be cost savings available there. One of the more beneficial things that we also see is to reduce the number of election judges required in polling locations in all instances other than the state general election. If there is a March township election, a primary election, standalone city or school board election, there is currently a requirement that there must be four election judges in the polling place at all times. In some of these instances, when you have a turnout that barely cracks 10%, that's a lot of time for election judges where they don't have a whole lot to do. So by reducing the required minimum down to three election judges, we anticipate that there would be a cost savings of approximately $360 per precinct in each biennium. This would aggregate out to about $1.1 million statewide per biennium. So we feel that's a very strong cost savings there. Again, that would be for counties and also more directly with cities and townships, as they are the ones typically paying the election judges. With a change in requirements for publication, there would be cost savings to the counties and cities and school districts of approximately $129,000 per biennium as well. And by changing the modifications of the post-election review to not require a post-election review of an office that is going to be seeing a statewide recount, we feel there could be cost savings there as well. For instance, in the 2008 U.S. Senator and 2009 governor races, both were required to be held with the post-election review, but there was already a statewide recount that was assisted in that area as well. By not having to conduct the post-election review prior to the recount, it would have saved approximately $55,000. So we do believe that there are cost savings to this bill. We think that clarifies several different areas that are just updating, and we urge your support of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson, for your testimony. Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, I see that Ann Lindstrom from the League of Minnesota Cities was planning to testify on this bill. However, in the interest of time, she has said that basically that they're supportive of the bill and doesn't need to say more at this time. And I think Grace Kelleher is here from the Minnesota School Boards Association and would like to speak to it as well, and then maybe we can do questions.
Excellent. Okay. We always appreciate saving time, so we appreciate that. If Ms. Kelleher looks like she's okay too, so I guess at this time, if there is there with that, we'll go to member questions, and we'll also ask in a minute if there's any other members of the audience that would like to testify. Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Halverson. My question is about the change on page 14 of the bill. And I don't know if this is a question for you or for Mako or for maybe Mr. Gearing, but I'm wondering what the reason there's a change here. It's page 14, line 14 and 15. Who need not be affiliated with a major political party is the language that's added. I'm wondering, I guess, what the problem is there, what we're trying to fix. And then also, if the fix is even right, because right after that on page 14, line 15, the rest of that line, election judges performing the duties in this section must be of different major political parties unless they are exempt. And I guess I don't know what those statutes that are referenced are, but what are we trying to get at there?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dowd, I'll answer your question briefly and then refer to Ms. Erickson. But the difference, I believe, here is staff and election judges, the volunteer election judges, that in a workplace, it's not always, especially in a small town, it's not always feasible to or maybe appropriate for individuals to be discussing their political party affiliation in the workplace. Election judges are volunteers, essentially. They get a small stipend, and so they do look for party balance among election judges in polling places. Ms. Erickson, maybe you could say more.
Ms. Erickson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dell, that is correct what Representative Halverson was commenting on. This particular addition, the who need not be affiliated with a major political party, deals strictly with staff who would be working on the absentee ballot board. Sometimes the ballot board consists solely of election judges, in which case that board would need to be required to maintain that party balance. If we do have staff working in the capacity of the absentee ballot board, it's important that one of the things that local election officials, whether it be county or city officials, they are supposed to be impartial and should not have to declare party preference with regard to their jobs.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my concern here is that, and I understand that, so if we don't want the staff to, or maybe I'll just ask a follow-up question, is that what we're getting at? We don't want the staff to have to declare what political party they are because they're supposed to be nonpartisan and impartial?
Ms. Erickson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dell, that's correct. In certain times, because the board is required to meet every 5 days or every 3 days, depending on when the election is scheduled to occur, in smaller locations, there may only be one or two absentee ballots that need to be reviewed by the ballot board on that particular day. It may not pay to have election judges come in, receive an additional stipend, and do that small-scale ballot board, where we can just have regular staff take care of that particular instance in those circumstances.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think so what we're saying is that staff can be doing this. We don't think it's a task that needs to have an election judge actually present for the task.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Erickson.
Representative Dell, not necessarily. In most cases, we are always going to use the election judges as the ballot board. However, staff may be assisting in the process or may be as a supplementary person with the board itself and therefore should be able to serve in an impartial capability.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Erickson. So the staff could be doing this without the election judges there, like volunteer election judges. So there may be nobody present when this is happening. That's performing these duties, which would be basically determining whether they can accept or reject within 3 days after receipt of the absentee ballot envelope. Is that right?
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Erickson.
Representative Dell, that is correct. That is the function of the ballot board. They're looking for the technical accepting and rejecting process. The accepting and rejecting part of the absentee ballot board is open to the public and can have representatives from any or either party or any other person who wishes to be present can observe that process as well.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Erickson. So right now, are they actually bringing in election judges who have declared that they are from one party or another to do these tasks, or are we just breaking the law a little bit?
Ms. Erickson.
Don't admit if they are, maybe just.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dowd, we're not breaking the law. We're bringing in election judges, and in some cases we are currently utilizing staff in this capacity as well.
Okay.
The difference is being right now we're asking that staff to tell us what their political party is so we make sure we have that party balance. The change that we would like to see is to still be able to use the staff but just not require them to have to declare that balance, that party affiliation.
Representative Dowd.
Okay, thank you. I apologize for the numerous questions. I just wanted to make sure I understood what was going on. I'm not sure I'm completely comfortable with that, but I see why you're getting at it, but I'm not completely sure I'm comfortable with removing the election judges from that process, or potentially removing them from the process. And then I have a question for Mr. Gehring, if that's okay, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Gehring, just the way the language is drafted, I don't know if you drafted this or if somebody else did, but on line 14 and 15 on page 14, we're saying the board may consist of staff trained as election judges who need not be affiliated with a major political party, period. And then it goes on to say election judges performing the duties in this section. Are we defining this well enough to say that, because we're saying that the staff must be trained as election judges, but then go on to say that election judges must be of major, must be of different major political parties. Is that well defined enough?
Mr. Gehring?
Seems a bit confusing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dowd, I didn't draft this language originally.
the disclaimer.
It maybe could be clarified a little bit. I mean, I think it's clear enough so that people will understand what the intent is, that if you have staff that are performing the duties of the ballot board, then they don't need to be affiliated with a major political party. But if you have separate volunteer election judges, then they do need the affiliation. I think the sentence works as it is, although you could probably clarify it if you wanted to.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Gehring. And to the bill author, I think my comment here might be what may make me a little more comfortable with this is to say that maybe define the staff and that it's staff in the whether it be the auditor's office or whoever, you know, I don't know, and I don't know if these staff take an oath to be impartial, but by just saying staff, maybe to get around having election judges, you're going to bring in, you know, school kids that we pay minimum wage to just do this, and they're maybe not impartial at all. So, but because we haven't defined that, we don't. You know, I want to assume that the auditor staff, who's actually conducting the elections, or whether it's a city clerk staff, would be impartial. But it doesn't say that they have to be staff for that office. And maybe it would help me feel more comfortable for defining that. And I don't, I'm thinking out loud. But
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Doubt, I think that your point is very well taken in terms of clarity. And I could ask Mr. Gehring if perhaps an oral amendment may be in order that would read something to the effect of the board may consist of staff, county or city staff, or staff employed by the county city, or alternatively, in the next line in 14.15, election judges who are not staff.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Doubt.
Maybe rather than, this seems like a minor thing, is this bill moving on? Is that the intent?
It will, it's going to the, Mr. Chair, it's going to be placed on the general register. There would be a possibility for us to work on some language to offer on the floor as an author's amendment.
I think
Representative Doubt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think maybe we can talk about this offline, and it seems like maybe a minor thing, and if we can both get comfortable with it, maybe we can co-author an amendment on the floor to either define it or fix it or something. So I don't have a problem with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Doubt. So Representative Halverson, we have your commitment that we'll work to some agreement and try and figure out some comfort language there.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll, we have you on the list. Do you have any questions?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple of different spots that I'd like to just visit about, and the first one is Section 19 on page 11. And the language change regarding the minimum number of election judges per precinct. I just want to bring it to the committee for discussion. I think there was some idea of four judges in a precinct because those were going to be partisan elections, and just based on the conversation that we had right now, we would look at trying to balance that out. With three, how do we get balance in a precinct? I'm not saying that we shouldn't go to three. I'm just asking the question, how do we get balance within a precinct or deal with voter questions on that?
Representative Halverson or Ms. Erickson.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I think that when we talk about having party balance, we always strive to make sure that we don't have more than a majority of one party represented. There are three major political parties in Minnesota, so at times we do have some judges who actually serve as representatives of a major political party or as an independent judge. There's also an opportunity in the statute to allow them to serve as a non-affiliated judge, so I don't think that that really is a major issue there.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Erickson. Like I said, this is something that I wanted to point out because that is a change from what people are used to seeing in their precincts and how that those election judges are selected. The next area, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Would be Section 58. I just want to mention that with 58, with the school districts like this, we currently allow, and this is more of a procedural question, we currently allow townships the ability to move their elections by resolution from March to the general election, if I'm not mistaken. I'm just looking for clarification so that these two, and anybody that's been on committee with me knows I treat all the children the same when it comes to political subdivisions in the state of Minnesota, that we don't have one provision for a county, one for the city, one for a school, and one for a township. That whatever that language is, that it's standard, so we don't get the coming back here, he, she, I, what, we kind of conversation. So maybe just some clarification from Mr. Gehring or others.
Whoever can answer. Looks like it's on page 25. Is that correct, Representative Driscoll?
Yeah. Some of my numbering is off on some of this, so I beg the indulgence of the committee and you, Mr. Chair, if we locate that. It's the provision that deals with the ability to move from a spring election to a regular election by resolution of the board.
Sorry. I was looking at the wrong section.
Me too.
Can you, Mr. Chair?
Representative Halverson.
Can you, Representative O'Driscoll, can you repeat that one more time, your page number and your...
You know, let's try this. Section 56, page 24. The ability to be able to move the election.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Erickson, I see Ms. Frazier has also joined us.
She just...
Okay. State your name for the record, please, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Frazier with the Office of the Secretary of State. The language in Section 56 is actually already current law, but it's only found in the session law from 1992, which makes it fairly hard to locate. And so putting it into the statute will make it easier for school districts to find it if they want to or are interested in changing from an odd year to an even year, an even year to an odd year. I don't know how this compares to what you were talking about with townships changing from November to March, but that's what I know.
Thank you, Ms. Frazier. Ms. Erickson.
The one thing I would say that the townships are slightly different is that the townships also have an annual election requirement that they have to place that on their ballot, so it's a little bit different language, but I think the process is very similar to what they have to follow.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Yeah, and to that point, cities have that ability, to move from odd to even, and part of that's from a cost savings and not having to incur cost of elections. I just want to make sure that statute is clear and treats all of those the same so we can avoid additional legislative committees like this to deal with what would otherwise be bureaucratic corrections or technical corrections. And I just raised that for the author maybe to look at to include in this technical correction bill. And one other section, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Proceed.
Section 73. And the reason I bring this up, and that's found on page 31, section 73, costs assessed. We had heard from the office of the OAH that they're running about $70,000 short right now with costs relative to this, and that looks like what we would be doing, if I'm understanding this correctly, the counties would be able to go to the same fund that the OAH has, and they're already running short of funds, and so we're going to maybe be creating a deficit here that's or exaggerating or exacerbating a deficit that already occurs from what we've heard from previous testimony from the OAH.
Ms. Erickson, you look like you're contemplating an answer.
Mr. Chair, I am. I'm trying to think of the right way to say it.
Take your time. That's very important.
The cost that, while the OAH, while their fund might be getting a little low, the same can be said when these costs occur against the counties. We don't have any type of reserve fund to pay for these, so if we are assessed these costs and have to pay, it's a much difficult situation for us to deal with.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Erickson, I hate to bring into the family fight, if you will, on this, but it's maybe something that we need to look at from a fiscal note issue at the state level. And so this bill may need a fiscal note because of that discrepancy that we've got.
Representative Halverson.
Representative, I'll just go, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this conversation forward. I think it's very helpful. I do know that I've heard of examples where counties, for one reason or another, have taken on tremendous costs related to ballot questions and other elected offices. And so that's why this provision is in the bill. But you're right in terms of when we mandate something that we should pay for it. And I'm in complete agreement with that. I would look to Mr. Gehring to see if there is advice around obtaining a fiscal note on this.
As he's contemplating that as well, being told that both the Secretary of State's office and the Campaign Finance Board have both stated that there is no cost there, and I see Mr. Goldsmith's in the audience. If we want to ask him, as well as if Mr. Gehring has a comment, he's welcome to comment as well. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, I don't know if a fiscal note has been requested on this bill. It may be the case that there is no cost to the Campaign Finance Board or the Secretary of State's office, although, you know, as Representative O'Driscoll noted, the costs are being shifted to the OAH, so they may have a cost estimate, and I don't know how often or what their expenses are related to these types of claims, so it's possible that they would have a number. Your bill doesn't appropriate money for this purpose, so there's no cost necessarily associated with the bill, but it could be a cost that they would have to absorb in their existing budget.
Representative O'Driscoll, any more follow-ups on that?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I have much more to add other than there's going to appear to be some kind of financial consequence somewhere along the line that we just need to address if we're going to the well twice instead of once when it's already short of funds, or at least been purported to be short of funds from testimony previously given to the committee by the OAH.
Are there any other member questions? I don't see any. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill as amended? Seeing none, Representative Halverson, would you like the last word?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you for the thoughtful questions and discussion. It's clear that we all have the same goal to make sure that our elections are administered appropriately, with integrity, and that this gives us an opportunity to certainly modernize our system, to look for ways to reduce costs to our local units of government, and I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. With that, Representative Halverson renews her motion that House File 979, as amended, will be placed on the general register. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Next on the docket is House File 863, Winkler.
He was going to be late. I'm not sure.
Okay, and he is on his way to the committee, and everyone can just kind of chill out for a couple minutes as the chairs swap and we wait for the author.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, Mr. Goldsmith, if you wouldn't mind, why don't you actually, or were you looking forward to a break?
Representative Winkler, we're doing a little changing of the guard here. So welcome to your committee, and I believe you can move your bill.
Well, Madam Chair, and I actually referred this to Mr. Gelman. It's my understanding that we are not going to vote today, that we're going to lay this over until next week for a vote.
There's still discussion.
Mr. Gelman.
Madam Chair, then I will move that House File 863 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. Oh, sorry, Committee on Judiciary. If we decide to lay it over subsequently, we can do that. Madam Chair, members, House File 863 is the recommendation from the Campaign Finance Board relating to campaign finance issues. It's kind of their omnibus bill, if you will. It encompasses a number of different changes that I think are significant in Minnesota, and in my mind, is I think demonstrates Minnesota's continued response and evolution in light of the Citizens United decision from 2 years ago, which essentially continued the U.S. Supreme Court's path of requiring that we have fewer restrictions on the way money is raised and spent in campaigns, but permitting us to have significant disclosure of where those funds come from. I think the Supreme Court's making a policy choice that is different from what Minnesota's had in the past, and that is why we have had a few or at least two significant changes to our campaign finance laws. We'll get into the details, but part of what this bill does is to significantly raise the contributions and expenditures that candidates have in their campaigns. And 2 years ago when Citizens United was first decided, I introduced a bill that did much the same thing. It required greater disclosure for independent expenditures, and it raised contribution limits so that we have sunlight on the third parties who spend money in our races and all state races, and increasing the expenditures and the contributions so that candidates who are trying to have a conversation with the voters have more of a direct control over the message that they're delivering and the money that is being spent, rather than basically constricting campaigns so much that they form a relatively minor part of the overall campaign message that is being delivered in their district. And as I look around the table, I see at least one member with a gavel who could probably share some personal experience with this. Other members maybe less so. But we're getting to a point where outside interest groups and their agendas are driving our political campaigns rather than candidates and their conversations with voters. And House File 863 seeks to change some of that around. Mr. Goldsmith is here, and he can go through the technical aspects of the bill, but I just want to do a quick overview. First of all, if you look in the first few pages, you're creating a ballot question political committee and political fund, which is essentially codifying in statute the way the campaign finance board has been addressing these issues in light of the two ballot campaigns in the last election. On page 4, sections 11 and 12 provide the campaign finance board some additional tools to enforce and investigate violations of campaign finance statutes or laws. Moving forward, we can probably skip the data practices section, unless Mr. Goldsmith feels a burning desire to explain that to you. We have had an overview of this already. Continuing through pages 7, 8, we have some changes to the penalties. I'd like to, you know, in the interest of time, and Madam Chair, members, my minimum wage bill is currently being heard upstairs at this very moment, so I'm going to try to limit my testimony. I'd just like to jump ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, if you want to, I'll go up there and take that over for you.
Representative Verdahl, you're smart. It's got 70% approval to raise the minimum wage. I'd jump on that if I were you. Just jumping up a little bit to the an update on page 16, section 34, is disclosure of donors for electioneering communications. This is getting to these ads that say, call Ryan Winkler and tell him to stop trying to raise the wages of low-wage workers and killing jobs in the process, and which is a fairly transparent desire to tell people to not vote for me, but is officially issue advocacy, and this requires some disclosure of how that money is spent in putting those things together. Page 21, section 36, is a response to the case of MCCLV Swanson, which challenged Minnesota's disclosure law for independent expenditures. There was a fairly narrow Eighth Circuit decision that was applied by a federal judge in Minnesota that basically allows any kind of fund, independent expenditure fund, to essentially go inactive if they're not raising or spending money. And then to the part that might interest those of us around the table the most, page 23, you see the changes starting in section 39 to the aggregate expenditures. And members, I would, you know, if you, for example, look at the change for the governor and lieutenant governor, it goes from roughly $2.5 million to $5 million. That looks like it doubles, but it's important to remember that we're switching from an election year cap to a total cycle cap. So it's not doubling. It's actually aggregating all those other years together. And as a state representative on line 23.32, I think it makes even more sense. So instead of having $34,000 in an election year and a relatively small amount, I think it's 20% of that, yeah, for the non-election year, this increases it to a total of 60 for both election years. At the same time, the contribution limits on page 25 are increased in a similar proportion to allow more money to flow through campaigns rather than through the third-party independent expenditure funds. And again, those numbers and those increases look very large, but they are also for the whole cycle rather than just for the election year. Let's see if there are any other highlights I want to get to. This is important too. If you turn to, I don't think I marked it. We are changing something in the way we require disclosure for third-party independent expenditures to capture more of the large donors who give to organizations where they have a significant share of their general fund money, where the total budget goes to political activities rather than just to the activities of the organization. So pick your nonprofit corporation that is involved in politics. If they spend significantly more of their funds on politics and significantly less on the public service purpose for their organization, we are going to require more of their large donors to be disclosed so that people can't hide their independent expenditure activities through a third-party corporation and essentially evade the whole purpose of disclosure. Personally, I think we could go much further. I know there are others who have heartburn over going this far in doing this kind of disclosure. But members, I would just really emphasize the fact that if we are moving to a world in which we have higher contributions, fewer restrictions on spending money and raising money, I think it is absolutely essential that the public has the benefit of sunlight, has the benefit of knowing who's paying for what. And if we do not start to capture more of those donors and make sure that we understand who they are, I think we are going to continue this trend of having it doesn't matter who it is. It could be mega donors on the right, mega donors on the left. It could be labor unions. It could be business. It could be anybody who are finding ways to influence the political process through their accumulated capital, and the public doesn't even know who's saying what on the airways. And I think that is very disturbing in a democracy. So, members, those are my highlights of the bill. There's a lot in here, and I'd be happy to take questions, and maybe Mr. Goldsmith could have an opportunity to highlight anything else that he sees as significant.
Thank you.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and thank you, Representative Winkler. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Rather than go through the rest of the sections of the bill, many of them are not controversial. I'd like to spend some time to talk about four sections of the bill that interest most parties, including people who will be testifying for you today. And those start with Section 5, which provides in Minnesota statutes a definition of express advocacy. The only place that the word express advocacy is used in Chapter 10A is in the independent expenditure definition, and it says an independent expenditure is an expenditure that expressly advocates for the nomination or election of a clearly identified candidate. But what does expressly advocates mean? The courts have decided for themselves what it means, and the Campaign Finance Board up to this point has had a position on it, though it has not enacted any administrative rule. So that definition is actually somewhat nebulous in Minnesota at this point. And for those who say that this statute actually makes things unclear, I think it makes things more clear than they are now because we have no definition. So the definition would take two parts. The first part was actually established by the case of Buckley versus Vallejo, which I talked to you about when I first addressed this committee. And Buckley said that you can require disclosure of communication if it expressly advocates for an election of a candidate. And in a footnote, the court said, we know it's express advocacy if it uses words like vote for, vote against, elect, defeat, and so on. And in subsequent cases, those became known as the magic words of express advocacy. And that's the definition the board began applying after Buckley versus Vallejo, because it was there in the court language and it was quite clear. The first part of the definition in statute, and that being on line 2.32 and 2.33, is the Buckley definition. And it's the definition the board has applied so far, although in recent investigations and advisory opinions, the board has suggested that that definition need not be as narrow as the board has applied so far, because the courts have made it clear that it need not be that narrow. And the courts took this up in a couple of cases, but I think the one that's the most important is Wisconsin Right to Life versus FBC. And this was Justice Roberts, who is, of course, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court at the present time. And Justice Roberts was looking at communications that people started to do after Buckley, where they avoided vote for, vote against. They avoided those magic words, but yet they looked for all purposes like communications that were designed to influence elections. And the court decided that the magic words were not a constitutional requirement before you could require disclosure. And in that case, in fact, they were prohibiting those types of communications. But you know, Citizens United undid the prohibition. And Justice Roberts said, and I quote, when you're looking at a communication and you want to know if it can be, if you can require disclosure, if it's the functional equivalent of express advocacy, you can require disclosure. And he said, the functional equivalent, a court should find that an ad is the functional equivalent only if the ad is susceptible of no reasonable interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a specific candidate. And that language forms the basis for the second part of the definition of express advocacy. We've taken Justice Roberts' words. And in other texts and other courts have made it clear that if there's a question, the tie goes to the communicator. We always err on the side of protecting speech, not requiring disclosure. So if a communication comes out that could be anything other than express advocacy for an election, disclosure would not be required. And for those people that argue that this is too vague, the point is that you have to almost intentionally be trying to reach that boundary between other purpose and the only purpose being advocacy. And the best example I have, I gave out in a handout previously, where a person in the last election intentionally ran an ad that did not reach that boundary. And so this would make it clear and would be consistent with what's required constitutionally.
Briefly, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, just wondering, and this is, I guess, in the vague category. I saw an ad that said, John Doe voted for the Viking Stadium. Is that for or against the candidate? It was confusing to me.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Is that an advocacy, is what I'm saying.
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, because that could be for informational purposes, it would typically, I don't think we could call that express advocacy, because there are other interpretations. Now, there's another provision that I'll talk about called the electioneering communications, which would bring that kind of communication into the disclosure system during certain periods just before the general election and the primary election. But if run outside of that period, I think the fact that you, being a reasonable person, have a question about its purpose, and the court says unless no reasonable purpose can person can legitimately question the purpose, we would err on the side of allowing the speech without disclosure. And of course, keep in mind that this never prohibits speech, and it never puts a limit on speech. It only relates to whether the cost of that speech has to be disclosed or not.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, members, I will move on to what I just mentioned then, which is electioneering communications, which Representative Winkler also mentioned. It's found in Section 34. As soon as the court recognized that functional equivalent was the same as express advocacy and you couldn't run these ads anymore that looked every bit like a campaign ad but didn't say vote for, the next tactic was to run ads that we saw in the last election cycle that say, call Representative Winkler and thank him for the minimum wage bill, or call Representative Winkler and tell him to stop destroying jobs in Minnesota. And so people were running these ads, and they weren't express advocacy because clearly they have another purpose besides influencing the election, that is to influence the representative on his votes. And so the Congress enacted an electioneering communications statute that regulates those types of communications, but only for specific periods, those being 30 days before the primary and 60 days before the general election. And the electionary and communications provision in the board's bill is further limited than the federal law. First of all, it is limited to 30 days before the primary election, but it's also communications are also exempt if they occur within 10 days after the legislative session ends. So in the event that we have a very early primary, people are always going to have at least 10 days to get their messages out to call your legislator and thank him or her for their action in the legislature. Also, we do not cover websites. It does not cover electronic mail. It does not cover member newsletters that are typically sent to members, you know, regularly or periodically. It has to be a communication that is either broadcast or printed, which could include billboards, targeted to the electorate, and published during those particular time periods just before the general and primary elections. And there are also financial thresholds. Again, there is no prohibition on speech and no limit on the amount of money that can be spent. It is a disclosure-only statute. And also, this statute results in the first case in Minnesota where an organization making these expenditures would not be required to register with the board. They would not be required to form a political fund. They could simply file a periodic statement telling us what expenditures they made that fell within that category. Also, there is disclosure of the sources of money that those organizations use for that money. And I want to move on to Section 49, which is the third and final change in disclosure that is included in this bill. And Representative Winkler mentioned this section as well. It was enacted in 2010 when corporations first began to make independent expenditures. And corporations don't only include business corporations. Corporations include lots of interest groups, trade associations, and so on. And those corporations typically are going to use money that was donated to them. And we don't know whether a corporation in that situation or an unregistered association has two donors that are financing all of its efforts or 70,000 small donors. The purpose of the statute was to reach those large donors who might be hiding behind the corporate veil and making those expenditures. The law in 2010 said that if you spend money on independent expenditures, and the new bill would expand that to electioneering communications, you have to disclose your donors if the amount of money you spent when you allocate it back to your donors exceeds $1,000 from that particular donor. Now, under the current law, organizations could use what we call a pick-and-choose method. So they could pick all of their donors of up to $999 under the new bill, up to $1,000. If that covered their spending, they didn't have to disclose anybody. And that actually still resulted in the ability to shield large donors. Under the new law, they would need to prorate their spending across their donor base. And so if you spend 10% of your money on electioneering communications or independent expenditures, you would attribute 10% of each donation to that spending. The other thing that we're doing, and it's not in the bill that's before you now, but it's in a bill in an amendment that I'm working on for the House version, and I'll be talking with Representative Winkler about a corresponding amendment. The other thing that we're doing is increasing the threshold before which a donor would be itemized, because it's not the goal of this bill to reach those small donors. So that threshold would be increased to $5,000. What that means is if an association spends 10% of its money on independent expenditures, electioneering communications, or ballot questions, a donor would have to give that association more than $50,000 before that donor would be itemized in a disclosure report. So that protects small donors. In fact, even if they spent 20% of their money on those kind of expenditures, a donor would have to give more than $25,000. And no matter what, no donor of less than $5,000 or $5,000 or less would ever be disclosed. So we're trying to build those protections in. I'm happy to have discussions with other groups who have concerns about it. This increase in the threshold has not been widely publicized yet, so it may be news to some. That same amendment will also be adding a new and very important exception to the electioneering communications provision that was requested by the nonprofit community, both Minnesota Council of Nonprofits and other specific individual nonprofits, and that would be an exception for what's called a nonpartisan voter guide. Many nonprofits put out voter guides using their 501c3 nonprofit corporations, and we've designed an exception for them so they would not be covered by the bill. I think the language is almost in its final form so that everybody who's involved, including interest groups, are satisfied with that exception. So, yes, we're adding three disclosure provisions. I think that they bring us close to being in line with the current thinking on disclosure. They're certainly in line with the Supreme Court's opinions on the matter, and they will bring Minnesota once more back to near at least a position of leadership in this area. Finally, I want to talk about additional jurisdiction that the board would be given over Chapter 211B of the Minnesota Statutes. In 2010, we asked for, and again, we asked for jurisdiction over three provisions of Chapter 211B. And those provisions are, first of all, the provision that governs the prepared and paid for form of disclosure. We already have jurisdiction over the independent expenditure disclaimer, so we're quite familiar with that type of language. The second provision would be the general use of political money. How can you use money raised for political purposes? We have jurisdiction over the non-campaign disbursement portion of use of political money, and in fact, the board has the ability to recognize new non-campaign disbursements. But there's no one that you can call to get an answer about how you can use your campaign finance money. The reason for that is that there's no agency that has authority over Chapter 211B except the Office of Administrative Hearings, and that's a quasi-judicial agency. They don't answer questions, make rules, or issue advisory opinions. They only hear complaints. So you can't get an answer from them about how you use your campaign money. And the final area of jurisdiction would be over corporate contributions. We get question after question about, what do I have to do if I want to put a sign on corporate property? Is this particular transaction going to result in a prohibited contribution? And we can't give an authoritative answer, and the problem is neither can anyone else. Now, some of the new provisions, such as electioneering communications and the expansion of definition of the clarification of definition of express advocacy, have some relationship to the corporate contribution prohibition. I think there's a little bit more work to be done in those areas to make sure that, like we did with independent expenditures, we put into Chapter 211B a provision that says if a corporation gets tripped up in the independent expenditure area, it's subject to the Chapter 10A provisions and penalties, not the 211B penalties, which include harsh criminal penalties. We need to work a little bit on the language. I'm working with the business community on that, and we'll continue to do so. With that, I will take any questions.
Members, we have several testifiers here, and I just want to give you a roadmap. I had at one point thought that we might be able to lay this bill over until next Tuesday. I know there are a lot of people who want to be heard about it, and there are, frankly, some possible amendment ideas at least percolating. What I've learned in the 40 minutes since I've been out, that I stepped away, two things. First, that this bill will not make first deadline in the Senate, so it's up to us. Second, that this has up to two more, maybe more, but certainly, almost certainly, two more committee stops to make in the next week. So there will be opportunities, albeit not in this committee, for members, for organizations, for advocates to make themselves heard. And Representative Winkler, I know, will be open to those ideas as this goes along. So we will be taking a vote on this bill today. And we have other testifiers. Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you be willing to bring this bill back to this committee at a later date? I understand that the necessity to pass it out so it meets deadlines, but could we bring it back here?
I would say I would never say never, so we should talk online. I wouldn't rule it out completely. So, members, I'm just going to go in the order that they're on the list here, which, as far as I know, is random. So we'll go with Tom Diamond.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Winkler,
I think this is the first for me where I'm simultaneously presenting two bills in two different committees that are significant, and I think I'm being called to go back up for the minimum wage bill. So I don't have the benefit of all the testimony, but I'm going to try to jump back and forth and continue the conversation as well.
Okay. And I assume people here know where you are, or soon will, so that, okay. Mr. Diamond, please introduce yourself and
Chair,
proceed.
Tom Diamond, Thank you for the opportunity to address on this issue. I would like to encourage you to retain the limits on contributions and spending. The Minnesota Campaign Finance Public Subsidy Program's purpose is to reduce the impact of money on politics. Increasing campaign contribution and spending limits undercuts that purpose. These limits are voluntary. I think it's really important for us to all remember they're voluntary. They only apply to those who actually participate in the program to help reduce the impacts of money on politics. Without these limits, it raises the question why we are investing $2 million into this program. Election year spending limits in the Senate would go from $68,100 to $120,000. Election year spending in the House would go from $34,300 to $60,000. Year-end reports of this committee members show almost all of you, in a $17,000 to $29,000 range. Election year Senate contribution limits, now this is the contribution limits, would increase from $500 to $3,000. Election year House contribution limits would go from $500 to $1,500. This increases the impact of large contributions on elections. Election year self-financing in the Senate would go from $5,000 to $30,000. Election year self-financing in the House would go from $5,000 to $15,000. This means a Senate candidate who self-finances $30,000 into a campaign can still get a public subsidy. The influence of PACs, lobbyists, and large contributors would also increase. The limits candidates could contribute in the Senate would go from $13,620 to $24,000, and only large contributions of $1,500 or more would now be counted instead of $100 or more. So it dramatically alters the influence of money on the contribution. There's a provision now for that the first-time candidates get a 10% spending increase. This would become irrelevant with these new higher limits. As far as if this is intended to address the issue of outside groups financing, one, they are have relatively limitless amounts of money, so increasing these funds would do little to impact that. But if the intent is just to address that, there's less draconian ways to do that. Right now, the program allows a 20% increase for those who have competitive primaries. So you could have a provision like that. You could also have an opt-out provision when there is demonstrated that there's a need to do. So I think there's ways to accommodate this program with the current spending. As I had mentioned on your just the members here, you by your being here were successful in campaigning, and you're successful in campaigning within the limitations of this current program. I would hate to see you let this program go completely away without looking at ways to do it within, still trying to limit the influence of spending on campaigns. Thank you,
Mr. Diamond. Any member questions for Mr. Diamond? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may not be a question for Mr. Diamond, but as I was looking at the bill and listening to your testimony about it sounded like Mr. Diamond was testifying that our per year was going up significantly when the change to the law is actually per election cycle, so that we're not having a small, there's not a small limit in the off-year election and a large limit in the election year, but that it's an aggregate over the two-year cycle.
Mr. Chair,
and I want to know if I'm
Representative Halverson. The catch is that two things. From a practical standpoint, it's what's spent in the election year on really matters on elections. And in most cases, that's where the money is spent. Also, if you take a look at the figures, what is allowed for both election spending and contributions is not the same. It still is an increase. Even if you take those amounts from those other years and add them up as an aggregate, it still is an increase. So it's an increase anyways, but in practical terms, it's a significant increase because that's not the way that most campaigns operate. Most campaigns operate in the election year, and new candidates operate in the election year. So it would allow the changes there. But it also impacts, because the other provisions in the code as far as in the statute tie into these numbers as to what a self-financing can be done is tied into these numbers on the election year rather than the aggregate, and the, what the large contributors can do is tied to the election year, not the aggregate. By changing these provisions, you dramatically change those provisions. And I don't know whether that's intended, but that is the effect of what has happened. So it's a compounding impact across the board, significantly overall changing the how these funding is allowed. And it seems to run exactly against, and considering that very few current campaigns do not fit in with the subsidy program, cannot comply with the program, that raising these numbers significantly, I mean, that virtually every campaign would qualify for the public subsidy, which Mr. then Dinah, raises the question is why is this public subsidy?
Thank you. And I wish we had more time. We have five more people and less than 20 minutes, so I'm really going to have to ask everyone to be very brief. Next, Jeremy Schroeder from Common Cause. Just introduce yourself and proceed.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeremy Schroeder, and I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota. Common Cause is a nonpartisan government watchdog group. We'd like to express our support for House File 863. Common Cause Minnesota's and thousands of members throughout the state believe that this bill is a good step toward better elections. However, we do disagree that the campaign limits for candidates need to be raised. We also believe that this bill does not go far enough in two areas. One, in financial penalties, and two, in the lack of language addressing the coordination between candidate campaign and other interest. First, we do not agree that the contribution limits to candidate campaigns need to be raised. Common Cause deeply understands the problem of candidates trying to be heard over the large moneyed special interest. But this solution does not address the bigger problem in our democracy, the influence of money in elections. Instead of changing Minnesota's system to correct the symptoms of the problem, which is the competing influx, competing with the influx of special interest money, we should be looking at ways to fix the problem itself and to hold tighter limits to special interest spending. Second, House File 863's penalties do not go far enough. A $5,000 fine deters no one with the current budget of modern elections. Common Cause would like to suggest treble damages, or three times the cost of the expenditure, to ensure that ignoring reporting requirements carry the penalty that reflects seriousness of Minnesota's elections. Finally, the bill does not address the issue of coordination between special interest groups, such as the Super PAC, and the candidate's campaign. Without safeguards and reporting requirements regarding this coordination, Minnesota elections run the risk of being influenced by special interest money, as limits for candidates can be bypassed by coordinating with a sympathetic super PAC. While I do point out the parts of the bill that do not go far enough, I must reiterate that Common Cause supports this bill for what it is, an excellent step forward for the elections process in Minnesota. We look forward to continuing to work together with the Campaign Finance Board and with the members of this committee to create the election system which incorporates the diversity of all the voices here in Minnesota. I urge you to vote yes on House File 863, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Schroeder. Any urgent questions by members for Mr. Schroeder? Seeing none. Andrea Rao from Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life. Thank you, Mr. Schroeder. Ms. Rao, just introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Rao, and I'm the Legislative Director for MCCL, Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life. And I have some prepared testimony that was, I believe, distributed to members of the committee. I won't read that. You guys can read that on your own. But I did want to talk for a minute about electioneering communications and kind of give you an example of what we're talking about as a small nonprofit organization and how this bill would affect us. I'd like to give you the example of a bunch of the work that MCCL does as an educational organization, an issue advocacy organization, takes place during county fairs, 4-H county fairs. For example, MCCL has a newsletter that we do distribute to our members. We have an edition every summer. I understand that would be excluded from that when we communicate with our members in that way. That would be excluded from the electioneering communications definition. However, we do often print extra copies of that newsletter and have it available at county fair booths so that people can get an idea of what MCCL is, the issues that we care about, and see some of the work that we do, and pro-life issues at the legislature. Typically, that summer edition of the newsletter would include a wrap-up of the legislative session. There would be legislators who could potentially be running for an election that would be mentioned in that newsletter. Based on my reading of the bill, then that communication would be considered an electioneering communication because it's not being distributed specifically to our members, but rather the general population. In addition to that kind of information being available at our fair booths, we would also oftentimes have a brochure, a pamphlet, describing a particular issue that the legislature had looked at in previous years or that we would like it to address in the future. Included in that may be the name of a legislator who authored that legislation. Straight up, just information, issue advocacy, but under the definition of electioneering communications, that would also be required to be reported. In addition to that, we may have, you know, at various fair booths, a sheet of paper with the voting record of the particular legislator representing that area. Not necessarily saying good or bad, but just talking about the pro-life issues that were before the legislature and how that particular person voted. Another example of an electioneering communication. It would be very easy with this kind of information to reach the thresholds required under the new definition and for MCCL then to have to report all of that. Now, that might not be difficult for a billion-dollar, you know, person who comes into the state and drops a few million dollars on a large-scale expenditure that would qualify as an electioneering communication, but when you add up these very small kinds of projects that a nonprofit like MCCL does, the reporting would be very burdensome. And we don't have a large staff, and it would be extremely burdensome for MCCL. So that is just one example of the concerns that we have as an organization. In addition to the strain that those reporting requirements would have, there would also be a chilling effect on donors to continue to contribute to MCCL. The vast majority of our donations are very small, but once in a while we do get a larger donation. Oftentimes, in that case, it would be from somebody's will. Either way, this bill would have a significant chilling effect on MCCL and other organizations' ability to engage in free speech. Regardless of intent, it does seem that the real effect of these burdensome reporting requirements is less to inform the public and more to deter citizens from publicly engaging in the issues of the day. Thank you for your consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rao. Again, members, any urgent questions for Ms. Rao? If not, thank you, Ms. Rao.
Somebody did leave their folder down here, too. They don't want them to forget it.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Knapp, John Knapp from the Coalition of Minnesota Businesses. Just introduce yourself for the record and proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Knapp. I'm with the Minneapolis law firm of Winthrop & Weinstein, and I represent the Coalition of Minnesota Businesses. The CMB was formed almost 20 years ago as a nonprofit corporation in Minnesota. It's registered as a lobbyist principal with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. It's composed of 11 separate business organizations that are engaged in public policy advocacy both during the legislative session and outside of the legislative session. The CMB tries to communicate with legislators in an election years by, for example, placing ads, thanking legislators for supporting the CMB's positions, or urging candidates to take a position that would be in line with the CMB's position. And the reason that they do this is because they find that an election year is, frankly, a very effective time to influence legislator and candidate positions. The CMB is not opposed to to regulation of political speech. After the Citizens United case in 2010, CMB worked with the Campaign Finance Board, we worked with Representative Winkler, we worked with Senator Rest in the Senate to pass a really groundbreaking regulation of independent expenditures, probably the first such legislation that was passed in the country. And as you may recall, there were only one or two legislators that voted against that independent expenditure legislation, and it was signed into law by Governor Plenty. However, we do have a couple of very specific concerns with the legislation that you have before you. The first is the definition of express advocacy, which is contained in Section 5. As Mr. Goldsmith stated, the first clause of Section 5 in the express advocacy definition is basically existing law. Express advocacy means a communication that clearly identifies a candidate and uses words or phrases of express advocacy. This is an objective test. This is the test that came out of the Buckley versus Vallejo case and says express advocacy is using terms like vote for, vote against, elect, support, defeat. We know what that is, and in fact, that's the standard that the Campaign Finance Board has been operating under. In the early 2000s, the Campaign Finance Board looked at going to a intent-based test for express advocacy, but they abandoned that in 2008 in the case regarding Minnesota majority. And the board clarified its position and said that express advocacy requires the use of specific words such as vote for, elect, or defeat. So that's existing law. The new law is Clause 2, which says that a communication, when taken as a whole, is susceptible of no other interpretation by a reasonable person other than advocating the election or defeat of a candidate. So we have, instead of a specific concrete test, we have a reasonable person test in terms of whether or not a communication is express advocacy. Well, why is this definition of important? Well, if a communication is express advocacy, then it's one of two things. It's either a contribution to a candidate or it's an independent expenditure. And in either case, it has to be filed with and reported to the board. It's also important because of the interplay between this provision and Section 211B.15 of Minnesota law, which Mr. Goldsmith mentioned. 211B.15 makes it a crime for a corporation to make an expenditure to promote or defeat a candidate. A crime punishable by up to 5 years in prison, and for a corporation, the penalty can be dissolution of the corporation. So it's not at all a minor violation. It's a very serious violation. And Section 211B.15 is not administered by the Campaign Finance Board. It's enforced by the county attorneys, the 87 different county attorneys throughout the state. So we're going, if this were to become effective, from a very concrete, specific test to a reasonable person test that's going to be in the minds of the 87 county attorneys, potentially subjecting both for-profit and non-profit corporations to some very serious penalties in Section 211B.15. The other provision that I wanted to mention is the electioneering communication provision, which Ms. Rao mentioned. And what it does is it takes political speech and that exceeds $1,500 and is not subject to one of the exceptions. But for that political speech, it's prohibited for 90 days during an election unless you comply with the registration and reporting requirements that are in this bill. Now, for some well-funded organizations may not have a problem with the registration and reporting requirement, but we just think philosophically regulating all political speech for 90 days of an election year is excessive. We do have some concerns that we want to discuss further with Mr. Goldsmith regarding Section 49 of the bill, which relate to the underlying source contributions, but I won't get into those today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate it. Unless there are urgent questions from members of the committee, Laura Wang from League of Women Voters. Just state your name for the record and proceed. And we have a very few short minutes here, so.
Thank you. My name is Laura Frederick Wang. I am the Executive Director of the League of Women Voters Minnesota. We are here today to testify generally in support of House File 863. I will say that because of many of my reasons for doing so have already been mentioned by previous testifiers, I'll keep it very brief. I would just like to say that we do share some of the concerns that were previously mentioned by Jeremy Schrader with Common Cause, and we look forward to working with the bill authors to address those concerns as the bill goes through the process. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Unless there are urgent questions of Ms. Wang, we'll go to the last testifier on the list, and that's Susie Brown from the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. Ms. Brown, just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Susie Brown. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. And I think the most important thing I'd like to convey is that almost everybody up here, including the bill author himself, has used the word nonprofit, but that's a general term that is applied really differently to different kinds of organizations. And I'd like to offer to be a resource to any of you who have questions about how the law treats nonprofit organizations differently related to these kinds of activities. My organization represents 501c3 nonprofits, which are charitable entities that do the work in your community that you see, like food shelves and domestic violence shelters and those kinds of things. We are specifically prohibited by federal law from electioneering activities and electioneering communications. I was concerned, and I've spoken at length with Mr. Goldsmith about the way that 501c3 nonprofits might be sort of accidentally captured in the electioneering's communication section. And I think that we're reaching some really good conclusions that will probably be seen as this goes through the rest of the process. But our interest would be that 501c3 nonprofits are able to continue in the same way that they have under federal laws, and that this wouldn't sweep them up to be inadvertently captured into this new law. And I also just want to note one of the things I haven't worked so far with Mr. Goldsmith on, but that Ms. Rao noted, is that the kinds of activities that we do, such as we may very well say in a newsletter, thank you to Representative Winkler for his great work on the minimum wage, for example, once... Well, somebody will say thank you in their newsletter, and those newsletters are distributed in a way that it may not be possible to control their distribution in the 30 days before the primary or the 60 days before the general election, because they live on in the community. So that's just something that we should probably consider further as this is going through the process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Winkler, any parting thoughts? And again, members, as you know, this is the time of year where even major pieces of legislation like this are basically cut short in terms of the amount that we have to debate. But we do have one and probably two more committee stops here, and there will be time for people to get their say and offer amendments as well. Representative Winkler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd just like to apologize to the testifiers for the somewhat unorthodox process here for me to step in and then step out. It's certainly not because I'm uninterested in your thoughts on this, and I remain very open to workable amendments that would improve this bill. And members, I do think it's important that we continue to evolve Minnesota's campaign finance laws as the court changes the rules for us, and so I would ask for your support, and I certainly commit to working with both sides and anybody else in the room who's interested in making this bill better as we move forward.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. With that, I don't know whose motion it was.
It was mine, Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler, of course, renews his motion that House File 863 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, members. The meeting is adjourned.